It's interesting, the last song we just sang, I found really resonated a lot. I don't know if I've listened to the words of that song as carefully as I did today. I feel like that really resonated with what I wanted to share today. July 20th to the 30th, I went on a delegation with Christian Peacemaker teams with the Indigenous Peoples Solidarity Project in Winnipeg. It was a whirlwind trip, 10 days. I'm not going to be able to share, you know, everything about what happened during those 10 days. So I'm going to share sort of two stories that were really meaningful to me, one kind of from the beginning of the trip and one sort of from more the end of the trip that kind of frame the experience for me. I have some pictures on the back that are on the projected behind me that will just kind of give some background. I'm not going to necessarily explain all the pictures, so feel free to ask questions afterwards, but just wanted to give you all a taste of sort of some of the experiences we had. On our first day in Winnipeg, we had the opportunity to meet with a woman named Grandma Shingoose, who is a residential school survivor. She spent some time with us sharing her story from her childhood before residential school, some of her time during residential school, and the impact that that experience had on her and her family. Grandma Shingoose is this tiny woman, warm, open, kind, and I think everyone in our group, myself included, really felt connected with her story. And it was a really powerful sort of experience for all of us, I think. She shared some stories from her childhood before she went off to residential school and described a very loving family, close relationship with her parents and her siblings, and it was really neat to sort of hear about that. But she also talked about her time at residential school and sort of being abruptly taken away from her family and what that meant to her. She, during that time, experienced all manner of abuse, and including at one point actually had to be hospitalized because of some injuries she received from the staff at the school. And after her and her siblings were taken off to residential school, her parents started drinking a lot, and to the point where when she was in high school, she actually had to be, during the summers between her years of school, she actually had to stay in foster care. Children's Aid took custody of her and her siblings. And despite all of that, she spoke very fondly of at least one of the foster families that she stayed with. She still has a relationship with them and really felt connected with that family. But on the other hand, there was also other families where she was essentially treated as a slave and was required to cook and clean for the family and eat in a separate room away from the rest of the family. And at one point during the presentation, so she was sharing her story, and at one point she got really quiet and said, I'm really having a hard time right now. And I was just struck by the vulnerability of that statement I know that she speaks with lots of different groups about this, and it struck me the emotional labor that this woman was doing for us so that we could have compassion on compassion with her story and what was going on in her community. And sometimes I think, for me included, for us to feel moved by a situation or by what happens to a certain group of people, we have to hear a personal account. We want to hear someone tell their story. And it just struck me what we're asking of people when they do that, and what that toll that takes on the people telling these stories for us, and if there's any way for us to be able to have compassion without that needing for people to give of themselves in that way. Grandma Shingoose was already also someone who was very easy to feel connected to. She told her story in a way that it was incredibly difficult, but it was also a very palatable story in some ways. We felt you were able to feel compassion for her. Not everyone who goes through a trauma like that is able to, you know, not lash out in anger or to share it in a way that's not accusatory. And we can't always expect people to be able to do that for us. On the last 3 days when we were in, so we spent some time in Winnipeg and then went on to Kenora. And the last 3 days we spent in Grassy Narrows. which is a First Nation about an hour, 2 hours from Kenora. And we were part of a women's gathering there, which was organized by a woman named Judy Da Silva, who and others, but brought together women from all different First Nations and other settlers as well to this community. It felt to me like they were really trying to work on supporting women leaders in their communities who are doing activism around supporting their community and also around protecting the water and the land. It seemed to be a focus on sort of transmitting some ceremonies to these women, equipping them as leaders, providing them with sort of spiritual and emotional support. And on the first night that we were there, we participated in a water ceremony, which was a beautiful ceremony where the women sort of made these food offerings to the lake that was beside where we were staying and sort of offered prayers to a protection for this lake. And it was a profoundly beautiful experience to stand with this group of women singing these songs in Anishinaabe beside the lake, singing in the four directions, turning as a group and singing these songs, asking for protection for this lake. While we were in Gracineros, we spent hours and hours every day just sitting, listening to drumming, and singing these songs in Anishinaabe. And after singing certain songs over and over again, I really started to remember the words, surprisingly, and just learn these songs. And I was just really struck by how beautiful these ceremonies are and the meaning that they bring and the strength that they bring to this community. And yet, these aren't my ceremonies. I could really appreciate them, and I thought they were very beautiful, but they aren't my ceremonies. My ceremonies are singing Praise God From Whom All Blessings Flow with a group of people here, or participating in children's time, or sharing during our prayer and sharing time here at Hamilton Mennonite. Sometimes I think I, myself, and I think a lot of us, have to fight the urge to want to, when we see something in another community's culture that's beautiful, we have to fight the urge to not want to own it, to take it for our own. And when I came home, I was talking with my dad a little bit about my experience, and we were talking a little bit about some of the Mennonite missionaries that from his church that used to go up to communities near Winnipeg as missionaries, and also some of the Mennonite residential schools that were that happened in the past. And I sometimes think as Mennonites, we forget about our own denomination's involvement in some of these things. And I often feel conflicted about how I can receive wisdom and meaning and, wisdom and meaning from the traditions that have been given to me through my ancestors, while holding on to the idea that there's also harm that's been done when we really hold on to the fact that this is the only way to experience God or the best way to experience God. For me, there's a lot of tension between living into my own tradition, recognizing that potential to do harm when we're so set in our own way of doing things, but also realizing that these are my traditions and it's not helpful to sort of try to hold on to or own other people's traditions. The women at the women's gathering were incredibly gracious and welcoming. Even though we weren't from their community, they welcomed us in with open arms. There were a couple of situations that made us feel a little bit uncomfortable, though. There were a couple of young women there who were, lovely and sharing with us, but they did mention at one point that there were a lot of settlers there at this gathering, and it made them feel a little bit uncomfortable. And this was a really hard thing to hear because the last thing I wanted to do or other people in my group wanted to do was to make people feel uncomfortable. And we also couldn't change the fact that we are settlers and we couldn't change the fact that we were there. We couldn't really just leave at that point. And also there was a couple of ceremonies that happened, one pipe ceremony in particular, where we were told that this is a ceremony just for the Anishinaabe women. And towards the end of the weekend, there was a woman who really generously offered to meet with us and talk and just answer any questions we had about the weekend. And she did offer some constructive feedback on some of the ways we had been interacting with the women in the community. And some people in our group asked her so the women during the ceremonies would wear a ribbon skirt for a lot of the ceremonies. And one of the women in our group asked, is it appropriate for a settler woman to wear a ribbon skirt or to make one? Or what are sort of the you know, rules around that, I guess. And her answer didn't really fit with what we had heard from another leader that weekend or from a younger woman also that had talked to us about this. And some people in our group really struggled with, well, how are we supposed to do the right thing if some people say it's this way and other people say it's this way? We don't want to offend anyone, but what are the rules? And to me, this was a very important lesson because I think sometimes we forget that it's a perfectly normal human thing to not always be consistent, to in a community of people to have different opinions about different things. In this church, we had an entire sermon series and Sunday school lesson series about communion and different interpretations of that tradition, how it should be done, who should be involved, who should be included. Even within this small community, we have a variety of beliefs about communion and what that should look like. And as settlers, we often talk about indigenous culture as if it's one thing. And we expect people to have consistent beliefs and to have homogeneous ideas about certain traditions. Meanwhile, indigenous communities come from a variety of nations, communities within those nations, and even within a certain community, there's going to be a variety of beliefs. It's unfair to expect indigenous people to have consistent and this, you know, the same beliefs about a political issue, about an environmental policy, about their willingness to share their stories, about including settlers in their traditions. And if when we fail to recognize this diversity, I think it's really dehumanizing. Sometimes I think as allies, especially when we are doing our best, trying really, really hard to not offend someone and to be respectful and to respect a culture, that when we're called out and told that you're not actually doing as good of a job as you thought you were, it's especially hard. And I think that one of the challenges when we're interacting with these communities is we have to do our best to educate ourselves, to learn, to try to find out from people what they would prefer we do, but at the same time recognize that we have blind spots, we're not perfect, and to be able to, with humility, accept that feedback, that criticism, and not let it sway us from our continued commitment to being allies. Thank you.
Jesus was walking one day with his disciples on the way to Caesarea Philippi, and they talked about all that they had been witnessing. They had seen people healed of the physical barriers that kept them on the margins. They had seen people fed when it appeared that there wasn't enough bread to share. They had seen Jesus teaching people who would not normally be welcomed by a rabbi. As they walked and talked, Jesus turned to them and asked, "What are you hearing? Who do people say that I am?" And they'd been in the marketplaces and eating in people's homes, so they gave him a list of the rumors. "Some people think you're John the Baptist, some Elijah, some other prophets have been named too." He probably wasn't surprised that people were looking to their past to understand God's movement in the present. He also asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter, front of the class, but not always top of the class, Peter answered, "You are the Messiah. You are the one who is anointed." Jesus knew he was right, but looked around the group at a few nodding heads, a few stunned faces, a few triumphant looks, and he thought, "None of you have any idea what that really means." "Don't tell anyone about this," he said. "Chances are you're just going to spread your misunderstandings of what I came to do." And then he began to teach them again to help them understand just what he had been anointed to do. "Anointed, you say, blessed with oil, consecrated, set apart." Yes, set apart from those who get to work a comfortable job their whole lives. Set apart from those who have one place to call home. Set apart from those who nod and smile in the back row of the synagogue, never rocking the boat with questions of biblical interpretation. set apart. Set apart even from the leaders and teachers who lurk suspiciously when new ideas come about. Set apart from leaders who protect their own and go quickly on the defensive. Set apart from teachers who don't want to learn anything new. Set apart to undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Anointed for this, consecrated, blessed, chosen by God for this. And this, Jesus said openly, this was not a teaching he told them to hide. But Peter, dear first-to-act Peter, tried to teach Jesus what was appropriate to say in mixed company. He took Jesus aside and reminded him of the line between public and private discourse. Peter rebuked Jesus. Let's not talk about suffering, Jesus. Nobody wants to hear about suffering. And Jesus, in turn, rebuked Peter, saying as firmly as he could, "Get behind me, Satan." It's a turn of phrase that stuns our ears. What could Jesus mean by that? He might mean, if you're playing the role of the Satan, the accuser, get out of my sight. Or he might be saying, Peter, those are the accuser's words. Get back to following behind me. Have you understood what it means to follow behind the anointed one, the set apart one? When Jesus asked, "Who do you say that I am?" he was also asking his disciples, "Who will you say that you are? Will you say that you are my followers when you understand what I have been set apart for? Will you say that you are my followers when you understand what you are set apart for? If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? You can gain the whole world but forfeit your life," Jesus said. "You can gain security, a good reputation, authority, and opportunity, but still be missing out on where life can truly be found. There is life in what we deny ourselves. There is life when we deny ourselves the frantic pace of busyness that keeps us separate from others. There is life when we deny ourselves the privileges of wealth that make our friends look only like ourselves. There is life when we deny ourselves the ability to remain ignorant of the injustices our neighbors endure. The good news sometimes asks us to be uncomfortable, to slow down, let go, and listen up. But there is life in that discomfort, even when we're afraid of getting things wrong. Disciples, allies, settlers in solidarity with Indigenous peoples, we will get some of this wrong. We will learn different things from different people. We, like the disciples, will sometimes say, "Aha, we know who you are and we know what you ask of us." And we may only have the tiniest idea of what we're talking about. But that's where the good news is found, in those discomforts, those mistakes, those losses, in losing our lives for the sake of the gospel, and therefore saving our lives, saving life. There is life when we slow down and pay attention, when we let go of our need to get everything right, and when we listen up and learn something new. And there is life when we start all over again. In speaking of denying ourselves, Jesus wasn't preaching self-abasement. He was preaching resurrection. The one who is truly human, the Son of Man, we say, must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. There is life in the journey of discipleship. There is life in the journey of allyship. It is resurrection life. It is dying to the things we use to protect ourselves: perfection, privilege, power, fear, and ignorance of the other. And rising again after we've gotten something wrong, after we've been taught something new, and after we've been asked to try again. Resurrection life does not avoid suffering or ask you just to get over it. Resurrection life recognizes and names the whole journey that it has taken in order for something new to be born. What will it profit us to gain the whole world and forfeit this kind of life? This resurrection life, this life that has seen death but is looking toward reconciliation. If any want to be Jesus' followers, ask what you must deny yourself, where you must slow down, let go, and listen up, so that life can come again out of death, so that truth can come again out of complicity, so that action can come again out of fear, and so that reconciliation can come out of brokenness. This is the life that Christ has saved and is saving and will save.